Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Ngo from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Thompson Guitars makes handcrafted instruments in Oregon. Their guitars are built with select tone woods, including Brazilian rosewood. Go to pktguitars.com for more information about their different models and appointments available from their custom shop.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. Hey, welcome to the show. I hope you've been enjoying the season so far. I've been having a really good time. It feels like we were working on this thing for like years, because we were working on this thing for years. So it's nice to finally get it out and nice to be getting feedback. Appreciate everybody on Reddit. Appreciate everyone dropping us a line on Instagram, Toy Harp Podcast, and telling us what they think of the show. If you have any suggestions for guests we should have in the future, get on the subreddit, go on the Bluegrass subreddit and drop us a line there, or find us on Instagram, send us a DM, Toy Harp Podcast on Instagram. So before we get into this guest today, I want to talk a little bit about what it's like to love bluegrass and not be in a place where there's a lot of it. I grew up in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and while there was one really good bluegrass band in town, other than that, there wasn't a scene at all. Yeah, I didn't really have any friends who liked bluegrass. There wasn't a whole lot of bluegrass TV or movies or anything like that. There wasn't YouTube. There was one record store where they'd get in some records, and if you were a young fan like I was, you had to be content with whatever they had. So anyway, one day I go down to Fred's Records in St. John's to their little bluegrass section, which might have had like four CDs in it. And, you know, one of them probably wasn't even a bluegrass record. You know, it was probably just like a country record that had an acoustic guitar on it. Anyway, there was this Rounder Records compilation. And man, I remember I bought it. It was more expensive than the other CDs. I think it was like $30. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. It's one of those recordings that every time I listen to it now, I realize that every song on it was at one point my favorite song. But my favorite track on the whole thing was this recording of a fiddle tune called Sleepy Eyed John by Laurie Lewis and Tom Rosum. Rosum? Rosum? Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, Tom. Anyway, I listened to it over and over and over and over again. And it wasn't until I got older did I realize who I was listening to. A pioneer of bluegrass music. Laurie Lewis is a pioneer of bluegrass from the Bay Area. Laurie Lewis is a pioneer for women in what's largely a male-dominated style of music. And Laurie Lewis, as you're about to hear, is a pioneer of collaborative rather than competitive bluegrass. I'm so grateful I got to spend some time with Laurie. She's an incredible songwriter, an incredible singer, an incredible tradition bearer, and an incredible creator of community. And I'm so happy she came on to tell me a little of her story. If you're not already subscribed to Toy Harp, please do so. Here's my conversation with Laurie Lewis. Laurie Lewis, I've been looking forward to talking to you. I want to go back to the sort of the beginning of it all. So your dad was in medical school, is this right? And he was traveling around, but he was also playing piccolo in an orchestra?
Yes, my dad played flute and piccolo in the Dallas Symphony while he was in medical school at the VA hospital in McKinney, Texas. So yes, he was a classical flutist, kind of specialized in piccolo.
That's a hard gig, you know.
Well, it is a hard gig, and he was really, really good at it. But he opted to go to medical school instead, became an anesthesiologist, and just sort of, you know, played music on the side with his doctor friends. There's lots of doctors who are also musicians, apparently.
Yeah.
And they would have woodwind quintet rehearsals just for fun at the house. And that's when I realized how much fun it is to play music with other people. Just lying awake at night, listening to them laughing and practicing things over and over again. You know, let's take it from the coda to the end or whatever they did. And they would just have so much fun, and it sounded so great. It, I think, was a real incentive for me when I started getting interested in playing music. Just playing with other people and that nonverbal communication.
I didn't know you could do that with classical music. Like, I thought only we, people like you and me, got together with our friends and played folk songs and played bluegrass music, you know, and Irish music and all that. I didn't know you could do that with classical music. You know?
Yeah, well, they did. They have a lot of fun with it.
Did your mom play?
No. She played a little bit of piano, and she just sort of did it for kicks. Yeah.
So you travel around with your dad, and you guys are moving a lot, and you end up in Berkeley when you were what, like 8 or 9 years old?
Exactly. I was 8 when we moved here. Yeah.
So that was beginning of the 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s?
That would have been, let's see, I'm going to tell my age. I was born in 1950, so that would have been 1959. I turned 9 after we got here to Berkeley.
So yeah, I guess you have to understand that I'm from Newfoundland, Canada, and I was born in the late 1980s. And the idea of Berkeley, California in the 60s is so romantic to me.
Well, you know, it was amazing to be here then. And I was, you know, I was 16 on this summer of love, you know, a pretty backward 16-year-old, but it was certainly all around me. You know, all of those things and the free speech movement and everything. And I honestly, I thought anytime we traveled as a family, you know, we'd go to Southern California or something. I just thought the rest of the, everywhere we went was weird. And then I realized that, oh no, Berkeley's weird. You know, everywhere else is a little bit more cohesive. And then there's this bubbling, revolutionary, all-encompassing cultural revolution sort of thing happening in Berkeley that wasn't happening other places.
Right. Because even outside of music, you must have been seeing civil rights leaders and you must have been seeing protests and you must have been seeing all that stuff, right?
Yeah. Going to SNCC meetings and basements and yeah, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
So, and I also know there was, in addition to like the jazz and the rock and everything that was happening in Berkeley at the time, there was a lot of string band music. I mean, you and I talked before I turned the microphone on about sort of my mentor in this music, a guy named Milo Rosenberg. And he was in the Redwood Canyon Ramblers.
Redwood Canyon Ramblers. I never heard them. I was like a teenager when they were playing around here and I never heard them, but I probably saw some of them wandering around the Berkeley Folk Festival because I started going to the Berkeley Folk Festival when I was 14. And I'm sure those guys were at the festival just hanging around, maybe playing music outside, or I don't know. But that festival was so instrumental, pardon the pun, in my musical upbringing and awareness. Because in my family home, mostly we just heard classical music all the time. My dad would turn on the radio to the classical station and that would be it. Or he would quiz us, you know, he'd put a record on and say, okay, what instrument is that? You know, that's doing that little part there. And we'd have to tell him what the names of the instruments were. He'd kind of quiz us. And usually it was trick question and the answer was flugelhorn. But aside from that, the son of my brother's piano teacher started taking me to the Berkeley Folk Festival when I was 14. And he was like 17 or something. And we got to hear Doc Watson and Gene Ritchie and Gene Redpath and Mississippi John Hurt and Reverend Gary Davis and the Greenbrier Boys, who just knocked me out. Frank Wakefield playing mandolin.
until she promised we'd be wed. We planned on being married in the spring. And through the long cold winter months, it seemed a spring
with... That was my first experience of folk music having that same sort of camaraderie of what I'd heard, you know, my dad and his classical friends doing.
You were playing classical violin at this point. Like, you weren't going there with a fiddle or a guitar, you know.
Right. Well, I started to teach myself guitar.
Right.
Got instantly really into folk music. That was during the folk scare of the 60s, you know, when that stuff almost became popular. I had started playing classical violin when I was 12, and I didn't really make the connection between classical violin and the fiddle playing that I was hearing much until I heard the Greenbrier Boys, and they did not have a fiddle in their band, which would have made a big difference to me, I think. But they said they had an album coming out, and the album was Better Late Than Never. And I remember I would walk down from our house in Berkeley, I'd walk down to the record store and ask, is the Greenbrier Boys' new album out? No, it's not here yet. Okay, go back home. Come back the next week. Is the Greenbrier Boys' album here? No. And eventually it showed up. I bought it. And it had Jim Buchanan playing fiddle all over it and fantastic fiddling. And at that point, I actually listened to it and I figured out this solo that he did on Alligator Man, which like goes up into the fifth position. At which I thought, okay, well, that's fine.
This bayou country is my home, and from this place...
Now I never go up there, but I worked it out by ear, and I probably didn't do a good job because I don't remember it anymore, but that was my first experience of actually thinking, oh, I might be able to play this music I love on this instrument. That I love the instrument, but I did not love playing classical violin.
Was your dad okay with that? Was your dad a bit bummed that you weren't going towards the classical music?
He was very bummed. Yeah, it was not what he wanted. You know, I mean, I was a rebellious teenager in a way, but also sort of dutiful. But when my parents got divorced, I was 14, and my dad really put a lot of pressure on me at that point to, you know, okay, classical violin, you know, take these lessons, do this, do that. And I didn't want to do anything my dad wanted me to do. So
who does? I mean, at that age too, you know?
Right. Yeah. But I stuck with the lessons and stuff until I graduated from high school early and I quit everything. And in fact, quit playing music completely because of the pressure he put on me. He finally decided, okay, she's getting good at the guitar and, you know, she wants to play banjo. Okay, now I'll jump into that. And he pushed me in that. And that was like, okay, now I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So I kind of wasted a good 5 years of my young life where I could have actually gotten good at my instruments.
I mean, you got pretty good. What were you doing? You were dancing. Were you dancing then? Is that when you...
Yeah, that's... I had to have some sort of art in my life. And I've always been a very physical person. And I just fell in love with modern dance. And in fact, I dropped out of college in order to take a job at a local dance studio where they offered me all the free classes I could take. I was going to be the business manager. All the free classes I could take. And... $100 a month. With $100 a month at that point, you could pay your $40 a month rent with your housemates and have the rest for food. Yeah. and get by.
It's sure it's the same now in Berkeley, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, it is so expensive here now. It's so sad. Every young musician has left the Bay Area. Yeah. I mean, they just have to move away because they cannot make a living making music in the Bay Area.
Yeah. It's the same here in Toronto. You know, you have all these musicians having to leave the city and things have gotten so prohibitively. So it's good to know. I mean, there was able to have a community there where you're able to make $100 and have enough for food and partying and anything else you wanted to do.
Yeah.
When did I heard a story about you and the Dillards, that like the Dillards.
I love the Dillards. Yeah. Well, I'm not exactly sure which happened first, the Greenbrier Boys or the Dillards, but the other major thing that happened in my bluegrass, young bluegrass life is that I went with my older sister to see the Byrds at the Berklee Community Theater.
Wow.
And the Dillards opened for the Byrds, and I flipped for Doug Dillard.
Who wouldn't?
He's so skinny that when he stands sideways and sticks out his tongue, he looks like a zipper. those were the jokes that I recall as I was, you know, 14 or 15.
Right, because they were funny. The Dillards
were like very funny.
Funny sort of bluegrass band.
Yeah. And so after I saw them, that's when I really wanted to play bluegrass banjo. And my dad hooked me up with a Cal student who played bluegrass banjo, a guy named Skip Soskin. And, you know, I got my hands on a banjo. He showed me the first tune I tried to learn was Doug's tune, which is kind of like not where you start. But there was not only that problem, but there was also the problem that, you know, bluegrass banjo, solo bluegrass banjo, except for like Noam Pikelny or Bela Fleck, that's the most lonesome thing you could possibly have. Yeah. It's such a communal instrument. It's supposed to be played with other people, other instruments. So I was just like in my room alone, practicing bluegrass banjo, and I just didn't have the self-motivation.
I know what you mean. Same thing for me out in Newfoundland. You know, I took banjo lessons with Neil Rosenberg, which was like the coolest thing you could do. And like one of like, imagine getting to do that, you know, and this is a guy who had played with Monroe and like, you know, managed. And then, but I had some friends who I had sort of like taught to play bluegrass. Like I had some friends who I was like, you know, this is how you do it. And you play along like this. But I started to learn all that Bill Keith stuff and the melodic banjo stuff, but just because it was the closest I could come to figuring out something to play by myself. You know what I mean? I know that feeling you're describing, you know?
Yeah. Well, for me, it just made it so that I kind of fizzled on the banjo. But the great thing that did happen out of that is that Skip left, you know, went back home for summer vacation and left me a big box of his bluegrass LPs. And that was ear opening. That was great.
Is that when Chubby Wise? I know you were like, you are a major Chubby Wise disciple. And I don't know many Chubby Wise disciples.
Not these days.
No, I wouldn't either. But I mean, I adore Chubby Wise. Was that when his fiddle playing sort of enters your life?
Well, it's all sort of concurrent. What happened with that is that my dad wandered into Campus Music Shop here in Berklee. Campbell Coe's campus Music Shop. It was like down a back alley off of Telegraph Avenue. And he walked in and he saw this LP of Chubby Wise and the Rainbow Ranch Boys. And it's got a fantastic cover of Chubby standing with his double-breasted suit on, holding his fiddle, and these guys all in matching cowboy shirts behind him with the pedal steel and the bass and the guitar. And he'd never heard the album. He just bought it and gave it to me. That was great. I just loved it. It turns out it's like the best Chubby Wise solo album that there is. He's playing with Hank Snow's band. And I think Hank Snow plays on it too, plays some lead guitar. And his playing is just so beautiful and so smooth and so sweet. And the first tunes that I learned and played with somebody else on the fiddle were off of that record. I learned a couple of the waltzes and played them for my older sister's wedding. And that was the beginning of knowing that I could, like, you know, put the needle down in the groove, listen to it, pick up my fiddle, and imitate what I was hearing.
So hold on, let's go back to you. So you were you get out of high school. Your dad's, you know, pushing you to play classical music, and he's also just pushing you to play bluegrass music and all that stuff. And you sort of say, I don't want to do any of that stuff. I'm just going to, you know, and you're dancing and you're living on $100 a month in addition to the dance classes and all.
Yeah.
So connect the dots for me here. So when does bluegrass sort of re-enter your life in a real way?
It's also serendipitous. I mean, you know, you start out doing one thing, you end up doing something else. I don't know. And then that's your life. What happened to me is that the husband of the director of the dance studio where I was working was a musician, and he played bass and guitar and various bands and was really into the, you know, jamming scene with the bluegrass and country musicians in the Bay Area. And there were a lot of them. I knew nothing about them. I was just completely immersed in modern dance. And he found out that I had played banjo when I was a teenager. And he goes, well, let's get together and jam. Bring your banjo. I go, oh, okay. And so I did. I tried to get together and play with him. And of course, I couldn't remember anything because it had been a few years since I played. And I was never any good anyway. So it was a flop. But in the course of that, he found out that I played violin. And he said, well, you could play fiddle. And I go, oh. And he took me over to Paul's Saloon in San Francisco, where they had bluegrass music almost every night of the week, or some kind of acoustic bluegrass folk, something going on there, mostly bluegrass. And there was a jam session every Sunday night or Monday night. It varied what night it was. And, you know, there were these fiddle players on stage, great fiddle players, and people were singing together and playing. There were a good mixture of men and women as well. It wasn't like the Southern Old Boy Network, you know, as though there were women fiddlers, mandolin players, bass players, guitar players, singers in all these bands. And I just flipped and I just quit dancing, got a job at a gas station, Jiffy Gas, and just like played my fiddle in the little office room between pumping gas and cleaning windshields for people.
Like just sitting in there practicing and playing tunes and
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you start working in a violin shop.
Yeah. Well, from there, I met Paul Schalasky at Paul's Saloon. No relation. He's not the Paul of Paul's Saloon, but he's a great fiddle player. And I started taking lessons from him, fiddle lessons. So I just learned tunes all the time. And then he said, well, let's go out to all up and down the Central Valley in California. Old-time fiddlers at that time, they've almost all passed away now, but there was a big bunch of fiddlers from all of the Dust Bowl states, you know, Missouri and Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas, that had moved out here during the Dust Bowl, and they brought their music with them. And there were fiddle contests, and they would all compete against each other, and there was a kind of a big scene with the old-time fiddlers, contest fiddlers. So Paul started taking, you know, we started going out to contests. And of course, with my classical technique and my in tuneness and nice tone, I could generally pull off a waltz and win on my waltzes alone.
Oh, really? You could do that? Because I was wondering, because I know that sometimes you see like the classical violinists come to the fiddle contest and they have the sort of raised wrist, you know, and it's not, you know.
Well, you know, I was never. There's that old joke, you know, you ask the fiddler, do you read music? And he says, not enough to hurt my playing.
Yeah.
You know, that's me. I never really learned to read music very well at all. It's slow and painstaking. I always just played by ear. So it was just a matter of adjusting to listening to other stuff and imitating that instead of trying to imitate David Oistrakh or Isaac Stern. I'm trying to imitate Chubby Wise, or, you know, one of the fiddlers that was around, or Paul Schalasky for that matter. So anyway, this is a long story. I was out at one of these things and I met this violin repairman, violin maker, and he says, oh, let me look at your fiddle. I showed it to him and he took I couldn't believe it. He took the scroll and he wiggled the scroll, and it had a neck graft. And the neck graft was loose, and it was just the pegs that were holding the scroll onto the fiddle.
Oh, my God.
And he goes, you need to fix this. And I go, oh, okay. And I didn't have any money. And he said, well, okay, I'll work on your fiddle for free in exchange for you coming in the shop and doing cleanup and stuff like that. So I started doing that. And then I had this other fiddle that was needed everything done to it. It's one of those really cheap German instruments, probably made around 1900 or something, where the neck block was part of the neck. It didn't have any corner blocks inside, and it had a bass bar that was carved out of the top. You know, just the cheapest fiddle that there is, except that at that time it was not bad wood. So he said, well, why don't we rebuild this fiddle? And I'll just show you what to do and you do it. So he showed me how to make corner blocks and showed me how to make end blocks and graft a neck and fit pegs, bush pegs, fit them and cut a bridge and do the bass bar. And by the time I finished it, he offered me a job at his shop.
Can you still do it? Can you still take apart a fiddle if you had to?
If I had to, I could take apart a fiddle. Another
thing. Yeah,
I could. The thing that would slow me up is sharpening all my tools in order to really do that.
And while all this is happening, are you, because isn't there a scene? Like, aren't there, isn't there?
Oh, there's such a scene.
Yes.
There are so many bands in the Bay Area and jam sessions happening and, you know, young people parties all the time. And I mean, I just spent my 20s basically hanging out in bars playing music. That's all I did. And worked in a violin shop, hung out in bars and played music at night.
Was Peter Rowan kicking around then?
Well, he was. He wasn't hanging out with us, I think, much. Right. But he was peripherally in the scene. We knew he was kind of there.
Because wouldn't he have been, like, because he comes from that scene, but wouldn't he would have been playing with Monroe at that point.
When my blue moon turns to gold again, and the rainbow turns the clouds away. When my blue moon turns to gold again, you'll be back within my arms to stay.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I did meet Peter at one point. I'd say it was must have been after I quit the Good Old Persons, which was like 1976 or 77, somewhere in there before the Grant Street String Band started. I played in a band at Paul's Saloon called Old Friends, and Nancy Josephson, who's married to David Bromberg, was in that band. And I met David through Nancy, and I met Peter Rowan. And they all lived in Marin County. And Nancy and I were in Peter's first iteration of the Free Mexican Air Force band.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's when I met and started playing with Peter.
See, in my mind, it's like, I mean, this is also romantic to me, but in my mind, those years where you're working at the violin shop and jamming all the time, it's like Garcia and Roman.
I never met Garcia.
He was kicking around, I'm sure.
And he definitely was.
And Old Men in the Way were happening, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah, we went to see them at the Great American Music Hall. You know, it's like, yes, they were all happening. And I was in, you know, I was in the amateur scene and they were in the professional scene.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't like David Grisman and you guys were.
No, it wasn't like we were hanging out. Although David was always so, you know, just friendly and open to me, you know, like I would show up at one of his shows and he'd say, oh, Lori, here, have my new album, The Grass is Blue, or whatever it was called, that bluegrass album that he did. You know, he just saw me there and he just gave me an album. You know, it's like, it's so nice. And I always felt like, well, he's way above me, but he was very, I mean, here's the thing about me. I was extremely shy.
Oh, really?
And I had a lot of angst around playing the fiddle when I started playing. I mean, I wanted to play. I really wanted to, and I love this music. But I was so scared to get on stage. And I had this long hair, and I would just like, if I had to take a solo in a bluegrass band, it would freak me out. And I would like almost, I would start crying. I was so scared.
Oh, man.
But for some reason, I kept on doing it until I became inured to it or something. I don't exactly know, but
I think the reason I'm interested in that, because it feels like, well, also David, wasn't David playing with Hazel and Alice too around then? Like he would have.
Well, that was before. That was that was in the 60s. They recorded together for Folkways.
I asked Alice about Grisman when I talked to her, and I said, yeah, wasn't Grisman with you guys back in the day? And she said, David Grisman, he was a punk. And that was all. He was just a young punk when he played with me. And that was it. Because it seems like there was like, again, this is fun. It's fun to get the reality of my romanticism. Maybe I should call the podcast The Reality of My Romanticism. But there was sort of this push towards, I guess, contemporizing bluegrass, but adding jazz and adding new acoustic music and all that kind of stuff. And then at the same time, in the same place, like in the same bay, there was also this great old timishness. Like I think Jody Stecker says, like he wants to play the music when there wasn't as much of a difference between old time music and bluegrass music, when they felt like they were the same thing, you know?
Yes. There were definitely these two scenes. There was this amazing modern scene going on that was, you know, Grisman with Tony Rice and Daryl Anger and Mike Marshall, you know, David's music and his scene brought these incredible musicians up into the Bay Area. I mean, Daryl had been down and he grew up in Santa Cruz. It's not that far, but, and Todd Phillips from San Jose, you know, he gathered them all together and they were rehearsing every day. And there was this like magic thing going on in Marin County. And then in San Francisco, centered around Paul's Saloon, was this bluegrass scene, which was totally full of Monroe acolytes.
Yeah.
I mean, not Flat and Scruggs. Flat and Scruggs were the main influence down in Southern California. But here in Northern California, it's all about Monroe. And I don't know how that happened. I just wandered into it and that's how it was.
Because it's the best. Like I am still such a Monroe. I don't think I've ever heard anything like it in the way his music changed my life. And I still go to it all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing about it for me is it's got so much emotional depth.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love Flat and Scruggs and I love some of those grooves that they got and stuff, you know, but it doesn't make me cry. Yeah. It doesn't like reach inside me and just squeeze my heart, yeah. You know, and it's like hearing Monroe sing sometimes is just like, oh my God. And unfortunately, you know, later he kept singing when he couldn't hit the notes and he sang out of tune. And I'm just like, oh, please don't do that.
Yeah.
But
born out of the psychology, you know, I think about that a lot. Like here was this guy who when his family, when people would come over to his family's house, he would have to hide underneath the porch. Like, you know, he's a cross-eyed child who wasn't allowed to see everybody else. This chip on his shoulder, this much more attractive, much more charming brother, Charlie, and they were together. And he was so much younger than everybody else. And just having this emotional center in his music all the time and a competitiveness and a...
Oh, God, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, he had it all going on in there.
Did he come to town? Did you see Monroe?
Oh, yeah. He would come. He'd play the Great American Music Hall, and then he would come into Paul's Saloon.
No, what? Really?
And Stanley did the same thing. Yeah. Yeah, they would come. It was the place to go. And there was some band there every night of the week. So, yeah, he would come into Paul's Saloon. Members of the Newgrass Revival showed up there. I remember meeting Ebo Walker. I guess it was the Bluegrass Alliance at that point. I'm not sure. He invited me to come down and jam in the band and maybe join the band. It's like, I was too afraid to take him up on anything like that. But everybody, they would just come in. Yeah. If they were coming through town, which they often were, they'd come in. Tony Rice would come in after a show. Grisman after a show. They'd all just come to Paul's.
Wow. So... let's go back to the violin shop. You're working at the violin shop. At a certain point, you take over the violin shop.
Yeah, my boss said he wanted to retire. Mm-hmm. And I think this was in like 1980. And he offered me the shop. You know, we worked out some arrangement. And I didn't know if I wanted to be a violin shop owner, but I knew that if I didn't take advantage of this opportunity, there would be some point in my life where I would be kicking myself saying, I could have been happy. I could have been doing this thing that would have made me happy, you know, like a violin shop. So I did it. I opened a shop. There were things about it that I really liked, but I was not a good shop owner. I mean, I didn't know how to make money. I wasn't interested in making money, really. Yeah. If a good violin or a good bow came into the shop, I would call up one of my friends and say, hey, I've got this great deal on a violin. You know, you can have it for $100 more than I just paid for it. Or something like that. You know, I was not good. And I ended up kind of just working my ass off and barely getting by. And then from there, I decided at some point, I inherited a little bit of money, a few thousand dollars. And I decided, okay, what I'll do is make a recording. I'd been writing songs and I'll just go into the studio and make a recording and put out my record of my songs. And then I'll go back to the violin shop and I'll have done that. But I asked Tim O'Brien to come and produce the album for me, and he did. And the whole experience of being in the studio was so eye-opening and mind-expanding and heart-opening for me that I just said, this is my path. This is what I want to do. I do not want this violin shop. And I sold the shop to the guy who was working with me there, my former boyfriend, and sold it to him for like a dollar. Said, it's yours, I'm out.
Is it still there?
No, it's not.
Well, I got a couple of questions there. One is, Dave Van Ronk has this great line that he said, the thing that he thought held him back as a songwriter is that he knew too many great songs. Like, he had grown up knowing how to play every Tin Pan Alley song, every single old blues song, every old country song. And he said, when it came time to write his own songs, he felt paralyzed by that. Not to mention knowing Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, but felt paralyzed by the amount of songs that he knew. When does songwriting come into your life? And you had no problem with that.
So how do you know I didn't have a problem with it?
Well, that's my no problem with that.
Okay, let's see. I have somewhere a little piece of paper that I wrote when I was a teenager. On this piece of paper, it says, I so want to write a song, like scrawled on this piece of paper. And for some reason, I held onto that piece of paper forever. And I never was able to. I would sort of try to. I would write prose. I would write some poetry, but I just never could make it be a song that I felt good about. But when I was in The Good Old Persons with Kathy Kallick, I mean, she was like way more advanced in terms of her own artistic vision of herself than I was. I was just wandering around having fun. And she was writing songs. She'd come to the band with a new song, you know, and we'd work it out. And then it would be one of our hits when we would play. And it's like, I have to say, I was probably, more than anything, it just made me jealous. I wanted that thing for myself. So it just started clicking, and I started being able to make these scribbles be music.
Relatively late in life compared to other songwriters.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was, let's see. Well, I wrote my first song, I think, when I was 26 or something like that. But it wasn't until I was 36 that I did my solo recording and, you know, had enough songs. I had like 7 songs or something that went on the first album.
I don't think that's a bad thing, Laurie. Like, I think that.
I don't think it's a bad thing either. I mean, I avoided the, oh yeah, 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 baby, baby, baby phase.
You know, I know exactly what you're talking about. I do. but I don't think there's anything wrong. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to for the Q show. I'm always really interested in people who start their professional music careers or their professional art careers a little bit later in life. And then, by the way, your mid-30s, which is what I'm in right now, it does not feel that late in life. But I guess actually right now it does, to be honest, now that I think about it. But listen to Williams. She told me she didn't start really until she was, you know, she was in her early 40s or something like that. And everyone has said the same thing to me, which is that when you start your professional career in your mid-30s, you don't make a lot of the same mistakes you would if you were in your early 20s.
Well, I think that's true. And also you've come to it because it's really what you, it's your calling rather than you come to it because you've been maybe groomed into it by your family or, you know, circumstances or something. And you come to it out of personal choice.
I want to ask a little bit about those first days when you were starting out as a professional musician. Can we just go back to the good old persons? Because yeah. You know, it reminded me of something that, so when I spoke to Alice Gerard about Hazel and Alice, I of course came around to the question of like, did you have any idea at the time that what you were doing as a woman in bluegrass was so radical? And she went, no, not any idea. I was just getting together, playing with my friends. She said, to be honest, no one really said that much to me. Like I didn't experience it. She said, like, she told me the story about remembering being like in a swimming pool and someone coming over to her and saying like, you know, you're an inspiration to me playing bluegrass. And she was like, what? I am? Like, I never really considered that before.
Yeah.
Well, persons come up a lot, especially in the sort of the conversation around women in bluegrass music. Did it feel like that at the time?
Well, the impetus for putting that band together was just to have a group of women friends get together and support each other. Our Kathy actually had just had a bad breakup and was kind of miserable. And she was newish, not so new, but kind of, you know, we were all in this scene, the Paul's Saloon scene together. And our friend Barbara Mendelson, who played banjo and hammered dulcimer in the band, she had this idea that we would just get together and jam once a week. And so we started doing that. And it was really fun. And we decided we would get together one set of music to play at Paul's on jam night. Because what they would do at jam night is they'd have, you know, they had a back room where people would jam. They had kind of two back rooms at that point where people would jam. And then they would have the stage. And people who had gotten together and jammed could then go do whatever they wanted to do on stage. And it's pretty cool. Yeah. So we decided we were going to get one set together and do our one set of music. That was going to be it, our goal. So we did that. And instantly, Paul Lampert, the owner of Paul's Saloon, saw that this was a great marketing gimmick. And he hired us to do a night at Paul's. And that meant we had to learn twice as many. You know, we had to learn, God, four sets at that point, four sets worth of material. And we jumped in and did it. But Sue Shalasky, who played mandolin with us, really didn't want to do that. That's when Paul Shalasky came on board and was our male member of the good old persons in the beginning.
You nodded when I said, Alice said to me, that she didn't know at the time that she was a pioneering woman in bluegrass music.
Yeah. And well, I didn't really either. We were just having fun together. And it wasn't until, I mean, when I was in the good old persons is when I went to my friend Ray Edlund's house. He had a fantastic record collection, the best record collection I'd ever seen of bluegrass and old time music at that time. He did a radio show called Pig in a Pen. And he said, just come over, you can play whatever you want and make cassette tapes of stuff, of material. And that's when I started realizing there aren't any women, you know, there aren't women out there with records and there's not. And then he played me Hazel and Alice and I went, oh, this is fantastic. And it had already been around for like 10 years. You know, it was old. I just hadn't heard it, hadn't. And it had Chubby Wise playing fiddle, which is like, there's my hero showing up, playing with these women. So Kathy Kallick and I learned some of their songs, started singing them together in the Good Old Persons.
I can't imagine showing up at some of those bluegrass festivals as the only women on the bill.
Well, you know, in our little cocoon of the Bay Area, it was not unusual at all to have women musicians playing. Yeah. It was unusual to have an all women band. That was unusual. And the first time we played, we got written up in the Oakland Tribune newspaper, a big spread with a picture of this all women band. And there, the first time we played at the little tiny Freight and Salvage, which held 78 people or something, there was a line around the block to get in, just because we got press coverage in a major newspaper, just because we were all women. Mm. Or as I say, the men loved us because we were all girls, and the women loved us because we were all women. Mm. But the thing about when I started working outside of the Bay Area, that's when I really realized that this is unusual and in fact not done. And in fact, I don't know, it was really hard. I mean, my booking agent at the time told me, you know, she said, I'm trying to get a gig at this festival, but they say, we already have our girl fiddler. You know, we already have our girl band leader. We don't, there's not room for another one. It's just, and I would go, you know, well, they would have Tony Rice and Larry Sparks and think nothing of it. They're boy guitar players, you know. Why can't they have Alison Krauss and me on the same bill? And Alison, of course, was like on a rocket ship. So she got all the festivals. And they would say, nah, you know, we already got our girl fiddler.
Did it feel safe at festivals?
Oh, for me, it did. I mean, there were times when I never felt unsafe, but I felt unwelcome.
Yeah.
I mean, there were times that I remember a jam session in Southern California at a festival where I was physically blocked from a jam session by particularly this one guy. He just did not want me in there. And he would move around and stand right in front of me and block me. And I just remember looking at his back and just being really pissed off. But I got the best of that because in that jam session was Craig Smith, the wonderful, wonderful banjo player. And he and I loved playing together. And he was my main guy, you know, for years. He was my banjo man and kind of the really set the template in my brain for what I want to hear the banjo sound like.
When you decide you want to be a professional musician, you start out, you're writing these songs of your own original music. I guess, how were those years? How were those first couple of years? Were they everything you wanted them to be? Were they?
Well, I was very, very lucky because at the time I released my first album, which was like 1986, I think.
Riding along with my
I think there were like 300 independent albums put out a year. I mean, a tiny, tiny amount. And I sent that album around. I mean, I personally boxed them up and sent them to every radio station, you know, that had any bluegrass show at all. And I remember finding out, like in West Virginia, there were all these radio stations that played bluegrass, and I sent one to every single radio station. And then I found out later that it was really just one program that went to all, to like 10 stations.
Right. So you had 10 out for one guy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, but I mean, I didn't know, but you could get that kind of coverage. And so right off the bat, I got a real leg up, and my friend Cash Edwards would come up and say, you know, you ought to be playing this festival, you ought to be doing this, you ought to be doing that. And I go, yeah, but I can't stand to call people on the phone. You know, I would sit next to the phone and go, okay, I have to call the Kerrville Folk Festival. okay, I have to call them. I think I need to go wash the dishes. You know, I do anything else and I make myself sit there. And if I made one phone call in a day or in a week, that was like a major deal for me because I had kind of phone phobia as well. That would be the one thing I would do. So finally, Cash just said, you know, I've decided I'm going to be your booking agent.
Yeah.
So everything sort of lined up for me.
And you go on to have this incredible and influential career in bluegrass music. And then like with a lot of musicians, and I mean this in the best possible way, it sort of changes. Like I talked about this with Tim O'Brien. I said, like, I felt like, you know, Hot Rise was a bluegrass band. Hot Rise was a bluegrass band. Tim O'Brien comes out and solo music. And the first record is a bit of jazz and it's a bit of bluegrass and all that kind of stuff. And then I said, I don't know what to call the music that you ended up making, because it's not like singer-songwriter music. It's not Americana music. It's not, I don't know what it is. It just sounds like your music. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you. And I would say that for you too, Lori. So as your music and your style progressed, how much bluegrass was in your heart? How much did you feel indebted to that music? How much did you want to move away from that music?
Well, I think that the way in which bluegrass has affected me the most are I love the sort of, I have to say that the hit and run aspect of playing with all acoustic instruments, you know, you don't have to drag around drums and amps and all this kind of crap. And I'd love that you can just play it without any amplification if you want to or need to. And I love the particular textural mixtures of the banjo, the fiddle, the, you know, the banjo, lots of little notes, the fiddle having this incredible icing on the cake type thing, and the way the guitar and the mandolin and the bass work together for rhythm. I just love all those aspects of what that music can bring. And I love the harmony singing. I love the close harmony singing. And those aspects of the music have been the things that I've held on to the most, along with the fact that it's basically singer-songwriter with string band. I mean, that's what Bill Monroe was, you know? And that's how I, that's what I call my music, singer-songwriter with string band.
And as, you know, Nashville stars started, I mean, you know, one in particular started recording your songs and your songs started taking off, did you feel any temptation to move away from the music?
Well, it gave me more, I became more sure of myself and more able to just say, okay, well, if I want to do this, I'll just do this. You know, it didn't make me want to be more of a bluegrass musician. It just made me want to be more true to myself, which, I mean, I have a lot of influences in my brain and they all just sort of come out. And these days I kind of want to follow whatever direction the song is leading me rather than say, it's got to be bluegrass. I mean, I just don't do that. And on the other hand, what is considered bluegrass has, I mean, it's definitely become big tent, as they say. And so you may as well just say it's bluegrass, even though I don't think it is. Because most people are going to say, oh yeah, that's that bluegrass music. Even though I'd say, are you kidding? That song's not bluegrass.
I never thought I'd end up like that. Like, I never thought I'd be, because you hear that story of Monroe telling Sam Bush, you know, that ain't no part of nothing.
Yeah.
You know, about bluegrass. And I never thought when I would heard that as a kid, I was like, oh, I'll never be like that. Oh man, I just want to be so open. And now sometimes when people are like, do you like that new bluegrass song? And I listen to it and I go, oh, that's not something. I know, but I didn't think I'd ever be like that.
Yeah, I know.
But then again, you have people like, I mean, Molly Tuttle. I mean, I can say Molly and Tatiana Hargreaves and calling you like a pioneer for them, a groundbreaker for them in the music of England.
I know. Isn't that the best? I mean, Tatiana and Molly are just such wonderful musicians. And the fact that I had anything to do with them being who they are, just, that's going to make me start crying right now.
It's meaningful. I mean, not just
as a
pioneering woman in bluegrass music, someone whose songwriting inspired them. You don't get moments like that too often in this life.
No, it doesn't get any better than that. That's fantastic. I mean, I don't have any biological children, but I'm happy to say I do have some amazing daughters and sons out there.
Laurie, this has been beautiful to talk to you. Before I let you go, did your dad ever get to see you become Laurie Lewis, like the Laurie Lewis that I knew?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yeah, and he was very supportive. And he learned eventually to stop telling me what I should be doing. He was very proud of me. And yeah, told all his friends and passed on my recordings to everybody. And yes, we worked out our relationship.
I'm so glad to hear that. And yeah. How's the scene in Berkeley now? Is there still a bluegrass and old-time music scene there? And
there is, but it's pretty small. I mean, most of the people who would have been pumping fresh energy into it, most of them have moved away. If they're serious about being musicians, they can't make a living here. It's too expensive, and there just aren't places to play. I mean, especially after COVID. I mean, we lost some of the few venues we had. I'm just lucky. I'm lucky to be able to still be here. But it's happenstance. It's because I put a down payment on a house almost 50 years ago, and it's like my little life raft, you know.
I bet so. Especially, I mean, I'm surprised Microsoft's not banging on your door right now as we speak, you know, trying to get it from underneath you, you know.
Yeah. There are a lot of, I get the standard things in the mail, you know. We want to sell your house for you, you know. But yeah, I'm not interested. Thank you.
I'm glad. Well, before I go, I'll tell you, you talked to me about the Berkeley Folk Festival and you talked to me about the Dillards, like these little tiny moments that lead up to like this big awakening in bluegrass. And I remember, it was Oh Brother for me, like it was for a lot of people of my generation, right? It was Oh Brother, and hearing the Stanleys sing Angel Band in that. And it kind of got me, you know, like it was the greatest. Oh, didn't you tour with Ralph Stanley?
I did. The Masters of the Banjo tour. I was on the bus with him for 6 weeks in, I think, 1983 and 93 and 94.
You got anything you can tell me about that?
Well, I remember the first show we did, I think, somewhere on the East Coast, maybe Annapolis, Maryland or something like that. And we got off the stage and I was walking next to Ralph back to the dressing room. And he said, he was so nervous. He said, I haven't felt that nervous in years, because he was taken outside of his band, outside of his support group, and was playing with, well, it was a good backup band, Dudley Connell, me, you know, Dudley and me singing with him, Jimmy Trivett on bass, Tony Ellis on mandolin. It's a good little band they'd put together to back everybody up. But it put him out of his comfort zone. And it was really good being able to hang out with Ralph and sing with him. He liked my singing a lot. He told me I had that lonesome thing. Oh, wow. Which he likes so much.
Yeah. Another shy guy or another shy man.
Yeah. And he was always just so kind and friendly towards me after that show. He said I was a real lady.
Thanks. Thanks, Ralph. Well, I'll tell you, so that early moment for me was, so yeah, Oh Brother in the Angel Band, and then, but I remember getting, my brother bought me the Rounder compilation.
Oh yeah.
The one that came out, it was like 50 years of handpicked bluegrass music. And you have to understand that in St. John's, we got nothing in. Like, we didn't have a bluegrass scene to save our lives. It was all like, we had Neil and we had a band called Crooked Stovepipe that Neil was in that was really good. But other than that, it was a lot of Irish music, Celtic music, that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of stuff I ended up playing. But he bought me that compilation. And it had you and Tom doing Sleepy Eyed John and Tom and Jerry on it.
Oh, yeah.
Way down yonder on Caney Creek, I whittle down a fiddle from a wagon seat. I tune my fiddle and I rise my bow. I'll play this tune wherever I go.
Sleepy Eyed John.
Better get your britches on.
Sleepy Eyed John.
You better tie your shoes.
Sleepy Eyed John.
Better get your britches on.
Try to get to heaven before the devil gets you.
Sleepy Eyed John had a wooden leg. The leg was another.
I could sing you every note of that recording, from the guitar to the bass to the fiddle to the whole thing.
It wow.
So you just never know when you record something. That was so influential to me, and how I understood the drive of the music, the happiness of the music, the joy that you can feel when you play that music. Felt kind of dangerous. It felt really cool. Anyway, if I talked to you and I didn't get to tell you that, and thank you for that, I don't know what I'd do.
Well, thank you so much. You know, that's Craig Smith playing the banjo on that, who I spoke about earlier.
Yeah. That was a big tune, man. That was a great recording.
Well, thank you. I listen to it now and I go, oh, I don't like how our time shifts there. I wish this were a little different. I would, you know, but it's got a lot of punch and a lot of power to it. And it's got a great sense of abandon.
I can't imagine doing this series about people who have been so important to the music that we love the most without talking to you, Lori. So thanks so much. And thanks for making the time.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thank you. You made me talk a lot more than I usually do.
I'll stop recording. Thanks so much to Lori. It feels like we recorded that conversation so many years ago, but what a great joy it was to spend a little bit of time with her. If you haven't listened to too much Lori Lewis, fix that. Fix that today. Thank you so much for listening. Toy Heart is produced by Stephanie Coleman and me, Tom Power. Our executive producer is Amy Wright and Ira Jacobs, with help, as always, from the entire BGS team, creative director Shelby Williamson, editor Chris Jacobs, managing editor Justin Hiltner, and all of the writers and contributors that make BGS the best source for roots culture redefined. Go to thebluegrasssituation.com. Our theme song, Toy Heart, by William Monroe, is performed by Chris Eldridge and Kristen Andreasen. If you missed our conversation so far with the likes of Larry Sparks, Sam Bush, make sure to go check them out. We have episodes coming up with the likes of Alison Krauss. I'm excited about that. And Tim O'Brien. If this is your first time ever listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Alison Brown, Bela Fleck, Del McCurry, so many more, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend who loves bluegrass music. Stay tuned for so much more coming up on this season of Toy Heart. See you soon. Later on.